Hey, everybody. It's in the Charlie Kirk Show. How do we reform our colleges with Ela Shapiro and Steve Kirsch on new vaccine news that will raise your eyebrows? Is it safe to fly? We ask that question. Email me your thoughts as always, freedom@charliekirk.com, and subscribe to our podcast. Open up your podcast app and type in Charlie Kirk Show. Buckle up, everybody. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Brought to you by Andrew and Todd at Sierra Pacific Mortgage. For personalized loan services you can count on, go to andrewandtodd.com, the wonderful andrewandtodd.com. I'm really excited about the momentum we are experiencing more globally and broadly, not globally across the planet, but just kind of globally in the movement of people that are really starting to say, hey, college is not what it used to be. We have to fix our institutions. We have to, for lack of a better term, de-wokeify them and purge them of these insidious elements. And one of the leaders is a very smart person, very articulate person, is Ela Shapiro. And he wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal called saying, state lawmakers can reform higher education. And boy, is that my love language. That speaks straight to the heart of what we talk about on this program and Turning Point USA. I'm excited to explore that with him. Ela, welcome to the program.
All right. Well, good to be back with you, Charlie.
Yeah, very good. Tell us about your piece. We'll go from there.
Sure. I was on last with you describing the outcome of my fight with Georgetown, where they tried to cancel me and said I canceled them. All sorts of illiberal tendencies my eyes were open to through that experience. And the problem that I discovered, you know, I'm a First Amendment lawyer, constitutional lawyer. I'm now with the Manhattan Institute. I've always been into free speech and due process. But what I really learned is that what's going on college campuses, law schools, elsewhere, is the bureaucratization. And this is not the decades-old conservative complaint about liberal professors, but rather in the time since I graduated college and law school, there's been this bureaucratic bloat. And most of that is these DEI offices, diversity, equity, inclusion, a really Orwellian name that goes against intellectual diversity,
yes,
prevents equal opportunity, and excludes anyone who deviates from a progressive orthodoxy. So I got together with some, you know, lots of people working on this issue, as you mentioned, my MI colleague, Chris Roof, and Matt Beyenberg of the Goldwater Institute. We got together and we thought, what can, from a public policy perspective, you know, a lot of people kind of throw up their hands, say the kids these days, or it's the culture, it's nothing for policy to do. But actually, at least with respect to public institutions, where a lot, actually the majority of college students attend public institutions, state legislatures can get involved. And we came up with four concrete, very straightforward proposals for what state legislatures can at least do with respect to public institutions. And I think you're probably going to want to go into that with me.
I do. So, I mean, one of the first things right off the bat that you recommend is that we have to abolish diversity, equity, inclusion bureaucracies. But, you know, Ela, I'll be honest, in some of the reddest of red states, let's take North Dakota, let's take South Dakota, it is difficult to even persuade Republican legislatures or Republican governors. It's, you know, we talk about the military industrial complex in D.C. There is a red state college cartel industrial complex. There's some of the biggest employers in some of these rural and agrarian based towns. There's a lot of corrupt development deals. There's people that sit on the boards. So first talk about the need to abolish these bureaucracies and then touch a little bit on the difficulty, but the necessity to actually go about accomplishing it.
Well, first, to be clear, very few people are against diversity or, you know, equity. What does equity even mean? Being fair? Sure. Everyone should be treated fairly, have equal opportunity for things. Inclusion? Sure. We don't want to exclude. What is this, you know, some sort of private club? No, everyone should, if you're admitted to the school, if you're hired, you should have good opportunities and feel welcome. But the problem is these DEI bureaucracies, as I said at the outset, are against all of those very basic principles, against the American principle of everyone being treated equally regardless of their race or sex or other immutable characteristics. Instead, it's the imposition of whether you call it critical theory, critical race theory, or gender-based, or what have you, but they've set up divisions and tensions based on race, based on so-called hierarchy of privilege,
yes,
and intersectionality, all of these very academic-y sort of things. And studies show that they actually make students feel less welcome and less included and foment tensions and divisions on campus. So the idea is not to roll back civil rights protections or allow discrimination based on race or anything like that. It's to what we want to roll back is the last decade or two of developments of these illiberal forces. Nothing to do, Charlie, with what faculty can and cannot teach, what courses are offered. That's a different sort of issue. But here, let the lawyers in the general counsel's office deal with state and federal civil rights issues, anti-discrimination and all that. But get rid of this, whether you call it woke, whether you call it theories coming in of oppressed classes, yep, teaching kids to think about everything through a racial or gender prism. These things are the things that are not healthy and that have caused the spiral of campus cultures where people are don't feel free to say their mind, where there are thought police that are going after, yes, them. And so that's why we're very specific in this proposal to go after DEI officers, not to, you know, leave the compliance with state anti-discrimination law and all of that, but these kind of imposing, indoctrinating, very radical theories. Get rid of that.
Yeah. And so, boy, there's so many directions I want to go with this. How likely is that? Let's take some of these red states. They're going to dive in. I mean, there's kind of like a deep state DEI cabal that's been built. You take Indiana, for example. That shouldn't be hard, but they have some of the most liberal colleges in America.
I just got an email just now as you were talking from Chris Rufo saying DeSantis is setting the table for this. So Florida's moving on.
He is, but he's exceptional. I mean, DeSantis is a gift from the heavens on this stuff. No, he really is.
Look, this should not be controversial. I mean, again, this is not a graduate seminar. You don't have to educate people on the dynamic taxation rates or anything like this. This is not hard. The talking points about this, you know, it's not even a matter of red state. I mean, look, I would wish that, you know, moderate kind of average middle of the road moderates,
agree,
you know, that are nationwide waking up to some of these abuses and the weirdness going on in our culture right now. So, you know, we'll work with state legislators. We're just getting started about this stuff. But, you know, in addition to these bureaucracies, the mandatory diversity training, which, again, are indoctrination sessions, and no one's ever been able to prove that having more diversity training leads to less racism or anything like that. Getting rid of political coercion, diversity statements. You might not be aware, Charlie, but to get hired in a lot of public places or to get admitted, you have to sign a piece of paper. It's like a loyalty oath, even though it's very clear for decades from the Supreme Court that that's unconstitutional. And yet they're requiring that and ending identity-based preferences in a whole host of ways. The Supreme Court might do that at a high level in its cases challenging affirmative action at Harvard, at UNC. But there are all sort of programs and scholarships and things that explicitly say you have to be BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, person,
yep,
of color, and all of this. Anyway, all of these left-wing radical theories imposed bureaucratically, compelling speech, violating due process in all these ways. Again, to be clear, I want to clarify this for all your listeners. This is not telling faculty members what they can and cannot teach. The issue of, you know, critical race theory being part of the curriculum, very different. And this is about public universities. This is not K-12. This is not imposing on what private schools are doing. We have lawyered this up, our proposals, which are very simple, but still, you know, they might not be perfect. And we will take suggestions from whether it be red state or blue state legislators that want to improve on them. But something has to be done. It's not just about the culture or despairing at the kids these days. This is something that legislators in their oversight functions of public institutions can say, look, we just want to abide by federal and state civil rights laws, provide more freedom, more opportunity, whether you're left wing or right wing, what kind of things you want to learn. But we just don't want to. It's not the job of bureaucrats to run these things. You know, academics, faculty, freedom, search for truth. That all is important. But it's wresting control of public institutions away from this bureaucratic academic industrial complex, as you put it.
I do actually think that if we lean too much on the premise of the Civil Rights Act and the regime of the civil rights kind of tradition, that it actually you're going to get more DEI. It's a controversial take, but Christopher Caldwell convinced me of that. So Ilya, let me ask you, where do you think it's most achievable or kind of to get this done? We have a lot of people watching the program that are lawmakers, that are involved, Board of Regent members. I suppose the answer could just be, let's try an all-of-the-above approach. But to your point, this shouldn't be controversial at all.
No, any state legislator that we've talked to, that the Goldwater Institute, who we've been working with, has talked to, it's a no-brainer. I mean, this is like an 80-20 issue, if not more. This is not getting into some of the more controversial things you were mentioning, Chris Caldwell's work on the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We can get into that.
Which I sympathize
and that's
with.
True. That's starting to be, you know, that's more, but this stuff, you know, not having bureaucrats run the show, you know, loyalty statements, judging people, dividing people based on race. These are not controversial things. You don't have to get into debates about what the exact nature of critical race theory is or anything like that, or the K-12 controversies. You know, this is fairly straightforward stuff, and it's not legally complicated. I mean, our model legislation and the issue brief that we put out, which our Wall Street Journal op-ed summarizes, is very short. And, you know, the different legislatures can craft that for their needs. But this really, you don't have to be a Ron DeSantis. You know, he just plugs away at this stuff and tells people like it is. And that's why he has success. And I think, you know, you can do that anywhere.
Hey, look, if you're Mike DeWine and you're afraid of your own shadow, you could do this. All right, pal? Like, you could step up to the plate and you could get this done.
This is a political winner. I mean, really, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to go against the idea that our students or our faculty shouldn't, you know, be judged based on whether they agree with certain kinds of political beliefs before they're hired or admitted, or that they're, you know, they get indoctrinated into theories that were discredited in the 80s and 90s as being way too left wing. And all of a sudden you have to adopt them to be able to be a student organization or to serve on a faculty hiring committee, things like this. Again, this is not the age-old conservative complaint going back to Berkeley in the 60s about the liberal takeover of academia. That's a completely separate issue. Curriculum issues are separate. This is about bureaucracy.
Yes.
And by the way, you introduce finances, right? State legislatures care about finances and student debt and all of this. The reason why college has gotten so expensive isn't because all of a sudden professors are being paid more. You know, it's a little bit because we're installing climbing walls and more fancy gyms and things like this, but mostly it's bureaucrats. And it's the ratio, not of faculty to students that's grown, but bureaucrats to students and faculty.
Yeah, the increase of desk workers with DEI mandates has just been extraordinary. So in closing here, this is a very ambitious effort. I want to applaud you guys for it. I think it's super important and courageous and clear, because far too often, and I'm the worst at this, I just get so abstract. I think we should abolish some of these colleges. You're like, okay, hold on. Let's start here, and then let's work our way forward. I can't imagine any sort of objection here. But the DEI kind of regime has been implemented in many different places. Ron DeSantis is trying to do this with the new college in Florida. You know, we have Ben Sasse, who I thought was, you know, a very mediocre U.S. senator, but I actually think he'll be a fabulous president of the University of Florida. I think he's really destined to do some good stuff there, and he understands the institution well. So, Ilya, in closing, 1 minute remaining, I see some momentum behind this, don't you?
Let's have a competition between the states, and let's have them experiment.
Yes.
I mean, look, there's plenty of – you don't have to adopt exactly what we've written. You can tailor this, and you can see – you know, Texas, you know, you start with the red state, sure. You know, the Dakotas, Indiana, you mentioned Oklahoma, they should all be taking a look at this and implementing it, and then seeing competing for students and faculty for that matter. I mean, let market forces dictate, you know, where people actually want to send their kids, where they want to study, where they want to work. Because I'm convinced that, only by putting in these kinds of measures will we have, and returning universities to their truth-seeking original goals, will we then be able to have broader conversations about the interrelationship between academia and the rest of the world.
You just violated a thought crime. Truth-seeking, you're positing that there is a truth to seek. You, how dare you, with your white supremacist, colonialist, misogynistic, bigoted view of the world, that you believe that there is a truth worthy of exploration. The college would say that you are your own truth. Ilya, God bless you. Thank you so much.
Good to be with you, Charlie.
This is a new year, and that means you need a new investing strategy. If you are tired of corporations who continue to push their agendas, then you need to speak to my friends at Pax Financial Group. I trust my money with Pax Financial Group, and they are fiduciaries who take pride in the fact that they sincerely honor Christian values. The time is now for you to move your IRA, old 401ks, or other investments to an organization that will respect your values. Check out PaxFinancialGroup.com or simply text Charlie at 74868. Text Charlie to 74868. That is Charlie to 74868. Joining us now is Steve Kirsch. Steve, welcome back to the program. So, Steve, there's a couple things I want to go through with you, but let's start with kind of the bombshell report. I'm going to play a piece of tape from Tucker Carlson's program. And God bless Tucker Carlson for being one of the few people with a major platform to speak about this issue. And then I'll let you riff from there. Let's play cut 73, please.
There's something pretty amazing that happened without much notice at all, without any explanation publicly. The FAA just made a major change in the health requirements for pilots with heart damage. The FAA has significantly broadened the acceptable EKG range for commercial pilots. Steve Kirsch reported this on his Substack. Now, the change now allows people with injured hearts, cardiac injury, to fly.
Steve Kirsch, walk us through it.
Yeah, they changed the PR interval. And so this is something that's existed for EKG since the beginning of the EKG, since the invention of the EKG, the what's called the PR interval, which has to do with a time for blood to go through your heart. It used to be in a range of 0.12 milliseconds to 0.2 seconds, so 200 milliseconds. And that's always been the top level of the range. They changed it now and nobody noticed it until just recently. And it's the U.S. Freedom Flyers that actually noticed the change in this. Nobody else noticed. And so they brought it to my attention. I was talking to Josh Yoder in a call, and he said, hey, you should really talk about this because it's not getting any play in the mainstream media for some reason. They moved the goalposts. It used to be 0.12 to 0.2 seconds, and now they changed it to 0.3 seconds, and you can now even be longer than 0.3 seconds. And if other conditions are present, you can still fly. So the point is that they didn't go and make people safer. They're moving the goalposts the wrong way to make flying more risky. And we think and look at the timing of this. This happened in October 2022. So it wasn't last year or the year before. It wasn't when COVID was a problem. It's only after people have gotten multiple boosters that they realized, and I'm speculating now that after multiple boosters, they've realized that pilots' hearts are now injured and are displaying abnormal EKGs, because why would they all of a sudden move the goalposts? And so when Tucker called them, they called the FAA for an explanation. You know, maybe it was, I don't know how that they could explain this. I mean, the cardiologists that I talked to were like livid. They've said, hey, it's always been 0.2, like forever since the beginning of the EKG, and the FAA just moved the goalposts, and they didn't give any reason for the change. So Tucker called them up, and he asked them for the reason for the change, and he basically got gobbledygook back. I mean, you can. I've listened to this segment several times, and I don't even remember. It is so strange how the FAA responded to that. And the other thing I know is I got a tip from an insider saying that they are censoring my post inside the FAA so people don't know about it in the FAA. So people will not get upset. I mean, I was pretty surprised to hear that they're censoring my post inside the FAA. Because I know they censor me at the CDC. They label my Substack apparently as dangerous content.
I mean, of all the agencies that would be focused on kind of like this health regime, the FAA was not be on the top of my list at all. It's very interesting. So what is the connection then to the vaccine? Is it reasonable then to speculate because of the mRNA gene altering shot that we are seeing heart abnormalities and the FAA is trying to not have a flight shortage due to the previously low standard? Is that an unfair speculation?
That would be a pretty fair speculation. You know, there was a Thailand study, and they looked at kids before. They looked at 301 kids, and these are basically teenagers, both boys and girls. And they measured things like troponin and other cardiac indicators, and everybody's normal before they get injected with their second shot of Pfizer. And then they looked at them 3 days, 7 days, and 14 days after the shot and measured what happened. And they were pretty stunned as to the rate of cardiac damage. In fact, the markers, cardiac biomarkers, and there are a bunch of them, changed in close to 30% of the kids that were injected. Now, if this were a standard saline shot, you wouldn't expect anybody's biomarkers to change like that. And, you know, even more troubling, of course, is the troponin rise. Now, there was a larger study that was done in Switzerland, and this study may never be published because it's so counter-narrative that no medical journal in the entire world is going to want to publish this because they don't want to get in trouble. But this is how science works. But what they did is they published an article where they said, where they told people the results is that after they were given the shot, it was, and they looked at it just 3 days. They didn't look at multiple intervals because when you get damaged, it actually can go up over time. So this may, but they found 2.8% of 770 people of all ages, 2.8% of the people had cardiac damage, meaning that they had elevated troponins that were above normal. That's not supposed to happen. That means you basically had a heart attack after you got these shots. And so I talked to a cardiologist just to make sure. I don't want to, you know, spread in misinformation. I talked to a cardiologist been doing this for decades. And he said, yeah. He said, you know, 2.8 is the minimum damage, because they only looked at one factor, which is troponin. And the people didn't get a cardiac MRI with contrast, which would be more of the gold standard of heart damage. They just looked at troponin, which is a pretty sensitive measure of heart damage. And 2.8% of the people had that. So if you extrapolate that to the U.S., that means that the U.S. government has basically injected, has injured the hearts of 7 million Americans, minimum. And it could be a lot higher than that. So that's kind of independent confirmation that in these well-controlled studies that the Thailand study, you know, found, I think, a fairly similar rate, you know, the 1 or 2 percent. But this one was 2.8%. So clearly we are damaging people's hearts. And so it's logical to expect and make that assumption that, yeah, heart damage, abnormal EKG, better extend the range. Otherwise, we're going to have to ground too many pilots.
So I sent out a tweet that got me called human garbage by everybody, seen 12 million times, where I committed a terrible crime, the crime of noticing. Can't do that, right? Yeah. You're not allowed to notice something and mention
truth
it.
Truth can't can't do that.
No, you can't even ask a question. You can't even notice a trend, right? Or else you're a terrible
right. No
person.
Trend noticing. That's bad. That's bad, Charlie.
Yeah. So I said this. This is a tragic and all too familiar sight right now. Athletes dropping suddenly. Now that happened to be right after the Damar Hamlin incident. Praise God, he's doing better. But that could be applicable to the Air Force poor young man who died on a way to class, who was a football player. It could be applicable to many other. So, Steve, just 2 minutes. Can you walk us through the data? Is it objectively true that we have seen a disturbing spike in young athletes and young, healthy people that are dropping suddenly?
Yeah, absolutely. It's happening in plain sight. We're seeing this, and it happens when people's heart rates go up. That could be after a tackle. That could be on the soccer field, soccer. We're seeing it in larger amounts in soccer players because their heart rates get elevated. And so it's putting more stress on the heart, which then is going to show you a more, instead of being it being a subclinical myocarditis, you're going to be seeing a clinical manifestation of that, which is people dropping or dropping dead from sudden cardiac arrest. On the field. So there's no question that we're seeing more of that. And it's not, of course, just limited to the heart. I just wrote a Substack on this happening for strokes. You know, the CDC has denied that there's any connection between the vaccines and strokes. And I just published an article on my Substack showing the proof, absolute proof, eight different ways. I looked at this eight different ways and show that the vaccines cause stroke. So these people are lying. And so I went out and I'm offering $1 million to anybody who will bet me on this, who thinks that the CDC is telling the truth. And, you know, in fact, nobody, even if I lowered it to 10 cents, nobody would even take a dime of my money because they don't want to be shown to be wrong. And so what I conclude from that is the CDC and the medical community are willing to risk your life, that they are right about the safety of the vaccines, but they aren't willing to risk even a dime of their own money that they are wrong. So they'll happily sacrifice your life.
Well, look, and here's the thing. I mean, the elites, I guarantee you this, the elites are going to want unvaccinated pilots. I guarantee it. Steve, stay right there. Yeah, they're going to tell their pilots, hey, make sure you're not vaccinated. Hey everybody, Charlie Kirk here, the inventor and CEO of MyPillow. Mike Lindell is always looking for ways to solve everyday problems. Have you ever picked up a towel set because it felt really soft in the store, but then when you go to use it, it's not very absorbent? It's basically a towel that's leaving you out to dry. That's why MyPillow has developed the MyPillow towels, towels that work. I know it's mind-blowing, towels that actually dry you. The six-piece towel set that includes two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths. They come in a variety of colors, and right now you can receive a six-piece set for only $39.98 with promo code Kirk. Go to MyPillow.com right now and click on the Radio Listener Special. MyPillow products come with a 10-year warranty and have their 60-day money-back guarantee. To receive this amazing offer on the six-piece set of MyPillow towels, go to MyPillow.com and click on the Radio Listener Special and use promo code Kirk. That's MyPillow.com. Use promo code Kirk or call 800-875-0425. That is MyPillow.com, promo code Kirk. So, Steve, let me ask you, are you starting to see a little bit of a trend? Because I see some of these articles here and there, but you follow this far more rigorously than I do, of kind of the vaccine manufacturers and or the adjacent approval bodies starting to kind of leak that this vaccine is not properly approved. I saw an article recently. Walk us through that.
Yeah, you may be talking about the CNN article.
I did. Yes, that one.
Yeah.
Yes. I found that interesting.
So there's an article on CNN, and it talks about that the members of the FDA committee are angry.
Yes, that's the article. Yep.
Yeah, that the drug company withheld critical information from them before they voted on these boosters, on these bivalent boosters, and they knew a year ago. And what happened is, and here's the exact quote. I'm going to read the exact quote from the CNN article for you because it's going to blow you away. It found that 1.9% of the study participants who received the original booster became infected. That's the original booster, 1.9 became infected. Among those who got the updated bivalent vaccine, the one that scientists hope would work better, meaning the number should be lower, a higher percentage, 3.2% became infected. In other words, when they, every time they inject you with these boosters, it's going to make you more likely to get infected with COVID. And, you know, I cannot find a single healthcare organization in the United States who would say that the more boosters, the better your protection. In fact, they all say the opposite. They all say the more boosters, the more cases we're seeing, the more COVID we're seeing, the more serious the injury is in the hospitalization, and the worse people do, and it increases their chance of death. I can't find anyone who can show me the numbers and who actually thinks the more boosters are better. And this is why at UCSF, for example, I'm talking to a nurse that used to work there who's in touch with the nurses at UCSF. She says, none of the nurses or doctors are planning to get any more boosters. Not even Paul Offit is getting any more boosters. And he's on the FDA committee that approved the boosters. So it's like, hey, it's not for me, but let's mandate it for you. And it's like, you know, my bet. I can't even bet people 10 cents. They won't even put any money at all, risk anything, risk a reputation, even for zero. They won't even bet me that. And we can have a discussion in front of an impartial a panel of six judges that we mutually agree on. And let's debate the question whether the boosters are beneficial, whether the vaccines cause stroke, whether the vaccines cause death, whether vaccines have killed more people than they save. You know, on that one, on that last one, which is the all-cause mortality benefit, only one guy in the entire world was willing to bet me on that. And he wouldn't even bet me the $1 million. He would only bet me $500,000 because he wasn't that sure of his position. But only one guy is willing to put his money behind to back these interventions. Not even the drug companies. See, that's the really troubling thing, is that the drug companies refuse to defend their own product. Look, we can have a debate for $10. We can have a debate for $1 million. I'll have a debate for $10 million. But they don't want to have a debate. They do not want to have a debate where one side can present and the other side can try to counter it, because they know they will lose the debate and then nobody will take the vaccine. This is why the vaccine manufacturers will never debate this with any of the people on my side. And it's not just me. I mean, they can make excuses. Oh, you know, you don't know anything, right? You're just an engineer. Yeah, I am an engineer that's looked at all the data. But hey, if you want to debate anybody on our side, we're happy to do that. But I don't understand why the drug companies don't stand behind their own product. It's probably because they don't have any they don't have any liability. They're completely protected in liability. So there is no benefit for them to go into a debate, because the only thing that will happen in that debate is they will lose. And then nobody will take these vaccines, and then their revenue will drop to zero for these vaccines. And that's what should happen. But you see, this is why they don't want any debate. Now, how is it that these manufacturers are not standing behind their products? They're willing to bet your life. They're willing to risk your life, but they're not even willing to risk their reputation to even talk about it. I mean, that is so corrupt.
Gotta go.
There's corrupt, no way to talk
about it. And my personal opinion, I think that they are going to have to find somebody to blame, and they're going to blame Donald Trump. I think that is their emergency escape hatch. They're going to say that he pushed them, they pressured them, used the White House to go after him. Out of time. Steve Kirsch, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Email me your thoughts, as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. Thank you so much for listening, and God bless.
For more on many of these stories and news you can trust, go to charliekirk.com.